are safe and in the hospital. Four boys and their 25-year-old coach remain in the cave. A diver involved in the rescue is talking about the boys and the dangerous mission to save them. Associated Press correspondent Rita Foley reports.
Eight boys have been rescued. Four others and their soccer coach are still inside the cave, trapped for 2 weeks now. Diver Ivan Karadzic has been helping to get them out.
They are some incredibly strong kids. Considering they've been through what can only be thought to be an absolute nightmare for these guys.
Rescuers are worried about the continuing rain and the oxygen levels in the cave falling to near dangerous levels. But diver Karadzic says the biggest challenge with these boys...
good mental health so they don't panic, because panic will create a lot of problems for us inside the cave.
He was on the Today Show. I'm Rita Foley.
Britain's Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has resigned. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Theresa May's office said in a terse statement that the Prime Minister had accepted the Foreign Secretary's resignation and would name a replacement soon. Boris Johnson quitting adds to divisions over Brexit that threaten to tear apart the government. Johnson, one of the best-known and most flamboyant members of the government, quit just hours after the resignation late Sunday of Brexit Secretary David Davis, the government's top EU negotiations official. Charles de Ledesma, London.
President Trump on Monday said he has confidence that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will, quote, honor the contract we signed for the North to denuclearize. On Twitter, he alleged that China may be exerting negative pressure on the deal. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said during a brief unannounced trip to Kabul, Afghanistan on Monday, that the Trump administration is increasing the pressure for peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Pompeo said the U.S. will support peace talks with the Taliban, but they must be led by Afghans.
We can't settle this from the outside. This will be settled by the Afghan people coming together. Their cumulative realization that living together in harmony and peace, treating each other with dignity.
Pompeo met with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah. He promised support for Ghani's efforts to open talks with the Taliban. A court in Myanmar on Monday charged two jailed Reuters journalists with obtaining state secret documents. The ruling moves the press freedom case to its trial stage. After 6 months of preliminary hearings, the reporters have pled not guilty to the charges. Iraq's Election Commission on Monday expanded its manual recount of ballots from May's parliamentary elections. Those elections were marred by allegations of fraud and irregularities. The son of former South African President Jacob Zuma is out on bail after a court appearance Monday to face charges of corruption. Starbucks will eliminate plastic straws from all of its locations within 2 years, citing the environmental threat to oceans. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Instead of plastic straws, Starbucks will use straws made from biodegradable materials like paper, as well as specially designed sipping lids that don't need straws. While plastic straws account for a small percentage of the waste that ends up in oceans, they've become a flashpoint, especially after a viral video of a sea turtle with a straw stuck in its nose. Some cities like Seattle, where the coffee chain is headquartered, recently banned the plastic straws, and others are considering it. I'm Julie Walker.
Ethiopian and Eritrean leaders formally restored relations on Monday. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki also signed agreements to open embassies in their capitals, restore flights, and use port facilities in Eritrea. Many Ethiopians expressed their exhilaration on social media and changed their profile pictures to a photo of the Ethiopian and Eritrean leaders embracing, which was taken on Sunday. Top story of the hour, four more boys have been brought out of the cave in northern Thailand. They'd been trapped there for more than 2 weeks. They're safe and in the hospital. Four boys and their 25-year-old coach remain in the cave. You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world around the clock at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
It is Monday, July 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump travels to Europe this week for crucial talks. British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson resigns over Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan.
Theresa May increasingly seems to be looking for what we call a soft Brexit.
And new research indicates Arctic mammals are at risk because of increased shipping. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump embarks on a week-long trip to Europe Tuesday with stops in Brussels for the NATO summit, the United Kingdom, and meetings with Prime Minister Theresa May and Queen Elizabeth II, and Helsinki with a summit with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin July 16th. The U.S. representative to NATO, Ambassador Kay Bailey Hutchison, expressed concern about what she called Russia's malign activities. Appearing on the CBS program Face the Nation, Hutchison said it is important to talk with Russia, as does the NATO alliance.
We have what's called a NATO-Russia Council, where the ambassador from Russia meets with our NATO ambassadors. Many of the foreign leaders in our alliance meet with Putin, most certainly the Europeans do, and our military does too. But this is to deconflict. It is not to allow escalation of hostilities. And also, I think the president will encourage Vladimir Putin to start changing their behavior. We'd like for Russia to be an ally, a trading partner. But right now we have sanctions against Russia because of their malign influence and the things they're doing that are very disruptive. So yes, we should be talking to Vladimir Putin, and many of our allied nations do as well. But it is to try to bring them in the tent instead of constantly seeing them do these things that are attempting to disrupt us but will not.
Hutchison said America's NATO allies are responding positively to President Trump's calls for greater burden sharing, with half of the 28 other members on track to spend at least 2% of GDP on defense by 2024. Jonathan Adelman is professor of international studies at the University of Denver. International Edition's Victor Beatty asked him if trade tensions with Europe over tariffs will influence the summit.
I think they may. We see what's happening with China already. But the president has definitely modified some of the things that he's done before. He has some learning capability. But he's going to have to see whether this is something he really wants to fight over, given something very important to him, which is the 2018 by-elections. He has to seem that he's in control. And as we're now in July and the elections are being held first week in November, this is very important. How he is seen.
Will tensions also be a problem over the pullout of the U.S. with the 2015 Iran nuclear deal?
I think many people presumed that would be so. I myself thought it would probably be so. But what we're seeing is that a number of European countries are doing roughly what the Americans want them to do. We look at the French, who have not been particularly willing to go along. And yet we see Peugeot already is pulling out of Iran.
Mr. Trump goes on to London after that. Big protests expected. The president hopes to strike a free trade deal with Britain. Is that possible?
I think it is possible because both countries are in a kind of unusual situation. Theresa May now is looking for creating a unified England that will go a little slower than thought before in terms of the Brexit treaty. So I think if there were to be a place that really is needy, shall we say, right now, of a special deal, especially as it moves out of the European Union, it's the Brits.
What are you looking for in the Putin-Trump meeting?
That is a 64,000 ruble question. First of all, it's amazing to me that this is happening at all. If I were an advisor to Donald Trump, I would certainly think that the first thing we're not going and shouldn't be doing is shaking hands with Vladimir Putin, given that the Russians have done some terrible things. So I think he's got to be very careful. Whether he will or not, I don't know. But if he goes out to what is one of the most disliked countries in the world these days for Americans and shakes their hand and he's enthusiastic and so forth, that could cost him politically.
That's Jonathan Edelman at the University of Denver. Helsinki will represent the first one-on-one between the Russian and American leaders, even though they've met twice on the sidelines of other meetings since Trump assumed office in January 2017. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Eight boys have been rescued from the flooded cave in Thailand. Turkey's president begins his new term with broader powers. Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein pleads not guilty to sexual assault. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo makes a surprise visit to Kabul, Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers in Australia have found that an automobile's natural vibrations can make drivers sleepy, increasing the risk of what is called drowsy driving. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration found, in the United States alone, that drowsy driving was responsible for 72,000 crashes, 44,000 injuries, and 800 deaths in 2013. In a new study, researchers from RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, detail evidence that normal automobile vibrations at frequencies between 4 and 7 hertz can affect a driver's concentration and alertness levels a mere 15 minutes after getting behind the wheel. The researchers made their findings after testing 15 volunteers in a virtual simulation of driving on a boring two-lane highway. They say that they want to increase the scope of their study to include a larger group of people. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, President Trump will unveil his selection for the Supreme Court later today. We'll have a report. Britain is in political turmoil as Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson resigned Monday amid disagreement in the cabinet over the nation's exit from the European Union. Johnson's departure followed the resignation of Brexit Minister David Davis on Sunday. Davis called Prime Minister Theresa May's approach to the nation's exit from the EU a dangerous strategy. May addressed the House of Commons soon after Johnson's announcement.
In the 2 years since the referendum, we have had a spirited national debate. With robust views echoing around the cabinet table as they have on breakfast tables up and down the country. Over that time, I've listened to every possible idea and every possible version of Brexit. Mr. Speaker, this is the right Brexit, leaving the European Union on the 29th of March 2019. A complete end to free movement, taking back control of our borders.
I spoke with reporter Jamie Detner about the significance of Boris Johnson's resignation.
Johnson's resignation today, I'm being told by a couple of my sources within the Conservative Party, is viewed really as a move of naked ambition, that he's anticipating there will be some kind of change to her leadership, which means that she, if she loses the leadership challenge, she'll stop being Prime Minister. He really, I think, feels now it is time to be breaking with her. I think it will embolden the 60 or so hard-line, hard-Brexit members of Parliament within the Conservative Party to decide to send the letters that are required, 48 are required, to the head of the backbench committee to trigger a challenge to her leadership.
Johnson has been seen, I think, by many as being very ambitious, and he's wanted to be, at least try to be, prime minister. But I've also heard that some observers believe that his moment has passed. What is sort of the general perception there?
Actually, I know Boris Johnson. I was at the Daily Telegraph. We're both journalists at the same time, the Telegraph. Yes, he is a hugely ambitious man. He made no secret when he was at Oxford University that he intended to be leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister. He sees himself as some kind of Churchill model. I do think, though, he may well have missed the boat. He challenged, as you know, the last time when David Cameron had to resign or decided to resign, challenged May, Michael Gove and others to the leadership. and handled it kind of badly in terms of that leadership bid. I think that he is no longer quite the darling of the Conservative Party in the country, and he may well have missed his vote. But, you know, the problem is this is a very complicated moment.
Earlier Monday, before the Johnson resignation announcement, I spoke with Jamie Dettmer about David Davis's resignation and the continuing uncertainty.
Well, he says he resigned because he could no longer support the British Prime Minister Theresa May's approach to breaking with the European Union. He's what's called a hard Brexiteer. He wants a clean break, basically, from the European Union. And Theresa May increasingly seems to be looking for what we call a soft Brexit. She's got this plan whereby Britain can still be part of what's called a single market in goods, but not have to accept the other principles of the EU, like freedom of movement or the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice, and being able to negotiate free trade deals with other countries outside the EU. So on Friday, we had this big meeting of the cabinet. She put forward her plans to be part of the single market, a strange cherry-picked deal she's trying to persuade the EU to accept. Everyone signed on to it, but then last night, just before midnight, David Davis resigned. We'd expected a smash-up, actually, for weeks. There are two kinds of negotiations going on here. One is a negotiation within the governing Conservative Party, which is very split about how to break with the EU, and many members don't want to break with the EU at all. And then we have this strange negotiation going on between a British government, which isn't being clear about what it wants out of its break with the EU and what kind of future relationship with the EU, negotiating with the EU at the same time in very vague ways. An interesting example about David Davis is, even though he was the Brexit minister, he felt very sidelined, and he's only had 4 hours of discussions this year with the chief EU negotiator, which is a bit strange when you're in charge of the Brexit negotiations as the British minister.
Well, is a soft Brexit really Brexit? Because it almost sounds like the pro-Brexit faction wants sort of, to remain somewhat in the EU, but they don't want to do the obligations that the other EU countries are having to comply with.
It's actually deeply complicated because the country is divided in half in one way between wanting to leave the EU and wanting to remain in the EU. Those who are wanting to break with the EU are also not entirely clear about what kind of future relationship they want with the EU. And opinion polls have suggested that quite a few people who voted for Brexit a year and a half ago, you know, are now considering maybe they want to be part of the EU, but not quite being part of the EU. So it's a very bizarre situation. It is very hard for the EU to negotiate with the British while, one, they're very confused about what they want, and they don't seem to accept the idea that they can't really cherry pick. I mean, this is one of the problems for Brussels. If they give a special kind of deal to the Brits in terms of they don't have to be part of, you know, European justice system, they don't have to have freedom of movement, a whole load of other rules, then the other members could start cherry-picking as well, and the whole thing will fray and collapse. So Brexit's never been very clear what Brexit is. I mean, in terms of the question that was asked of the British public to vote in the referendum, it just said, do you want to leave the European Union? But there's lots of other things that could happen. They could be like Norway and be a member of EFTA, which is another European grouping which is aligned with the European Union. So, in fact, the question was a question that was too vague.
Jamie Dettmer reporting. President Trump will announce his nominee for the Supreme Court Monday to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. The announcement is likely to set off a major confirmation battle in the Senate, where Republicans hold a narrow majority and where opposition Democrats are planning to wage a fight over Trump's court pick. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
During a campaign rally in Montana, President Trump sought to build expectations among supporters for his upcoming Supreme Court announcement.
As you know, there's now a vacancy on the Supreme Court. And if you turn in Monday at 9 o'clock, I think you're going to be extremely happy with the selection, right? And they're all great.
Trump will nominate a replacement for retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. Though generally conservative, Kennedy was a critical swing vote in a number of high-profile cases, including same-sex marriage and upholding the right to an abortion. Democrats have vowed to resist a nominee who could swing the high court further to the right, including Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota.
So it makes it all the more important that we get someone that is going to be a person of integrity and someone that's going to make a decision based on precedent, based on the rule of law, and not someone who's ideological.
Kennedy's record of casting critical votes in key cases leaves a void on the high court, says analyst Jonathan Turley.
He leaves the court in a calcified state of a hardened left and right with nobody in that middle position.
Conservatives now see a chance to solidify a majority on the Supreme Court for years to come, says expert John Fortier.
I think many on the right feel in particular that Anthony Kennedy, while broadly on the conservative side, was not as consistent as he might have been, and that the nominee of Donald Trump will have the court be much more consistently five votes in the conservative direction.
A firmly conservative nominee will spark a high-stakes political battle in the Senate, says legal analyst Paul Schiff Berman.
I think that we probably have never seen an appointment process that will be as contentious as this one, given the importance of Kennedy's position on the court and the increasingly polarized state of the nation.
Trump's nominee must be confirmed by the Senate, where Republicans hold a narrow 51-49 seat majority. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. The polar bear may be the classic poster child for climate change, but it's far from the only animal threatened by a warming Arctic. Because the region is warming 2 to 3 times more quickly than the rest of the planet, the rapidly melting sea ice is opening new shipping lanes. New research suggests increased vessel traffic through Arctic waters is putting other animals at risk. Sadie Witkowski reports.
Maritime traffic is dramatically increasing in the relatively untouched Arctic Ocean as receding sea ice clears the historically dangerous Northwest Passage and the Northern Sea Route along Russia's northern coast. The effect on the fragile ecosystem caught the attention of Donna Hauser from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks.
We're on the precipice. We're poised for a lot of vessel traffic to increase in the Arctic, and so part of what motivated the study is to understand where we're at and where we need to go.
The marine biologist was interested in assessing the vulnerability of Arctic marine mammals to shipping activity to protect both the species and the people who rely on them.
All of these species are really important traditional resources for the indigenous communities throughout the Arctic, as well as in Alaska and the Alaskan Arctic in particular.
Hauser and her co-authors looked at 7 Arctic species, including seals, whales, and polar bears. They created a vulnerability measure based on a combination of the animal's exposure to shipping traffic and its general sensitivity. They limited their assessment to September, when the sea ice is at its lowest point and most ships pass through Arctic waters. Their research found that narwhals and other whale species were the most vulnerable to late summer ship traffic and polar bears were the least, with walruses and seals in between. Co-author Kristen Lydra of the Polar Ice Institute explained why narwhals and other cetaceans are especially affected.
Ships, in general, generate underwater noise, and that underwater noise is a disturbance for marine mammals, especially different whale species that rely on sound to pretty much do everything.
Narwhals in particular are at risk because of a combined effect of their high exposure and sensitivity. This puts the so-called unicorns of the sea in the most perilous position of all the Arctic marine mammals, with other whales facing similar but less extreme circumstances. Polar bears, on the other hand, seem to be the best equipped to deal with the late summer vessel traffic.
At that time of year, polar bears tend to be either on land or they've followed the pack ice north.
Hauser pointed to a second reason the bears were less vulnerable.
They don't use sound in the same way as the other marine mammals do. And so some of those things that make the other species sensitive to vessels aren't as big of a factor for polar bears.
This is the first study to compare effects of increased ship traffic across the major Arctic marine mammal species and determine which might be most in need of conservation efforts. In order to help protect these sentinel species, and whales in particular, the authors suggest requiring ships to move at slower speeds to reduce collisions with whales. In addition, placing limits on the amount of noise vessels can make will protect whales' delicate hearing. The Marine Mammal Commission's Randall Reeves recognizes the need for research on the Arctic mammals' changing landscape.
It's not realistic to think that we're going to stop people from taking advantage of these passages through formerly pristine regions, so the ships are going to go there.
By understanding which marine mammals are at risk, researchers can help plan for an uncertain future. Sadie Witkowski, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is set to apply maximum economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran to induce Iran's leaders to change their destabilizing policies, including their support for terrorism, missile proliferation, and impoverishment of the Iranian people. U.S. sanctions targeting Iran's automotive sector, trade in gold, and other key metals will snap back on August 6th. Sanctions targeting Iran's energy sector and petroleum-related transactions with the Central Bank of Iran will be reimposed November 4th. U.S. State Department Director of Policy Planning Brian Hook told reporters that the U.S. goal in relation to energy sanctions is to increase pressure on the Iranian regime by reducing to zero its revenue from crude oil sales. The U.S., he added, is working to minimize disruptions to the global market, but we are confident that there is sufficient global spare oil production capacity. Director Hook pointed out that U.S. sanctions do not now, nor have they ever targeted humanitarian goods.
Our sanctions pressure the Iranian regime into changing its behavior, and they do not target the Iranian people. The United States does not sanction the export of food or medicine to Iran.
In addition to applying economic pressure, another priority for the U.S. is standing in solidarity with the Iranian people, the longest suffering victims of the regime.
The average Iranian today is struggling to afford basics like water, bread, and eggs. At the same time, the Iranian regime is squandering millions of dollars on violent misadventures abroad. These serve no purpose other than to prolong pain and suffering of men, women, and children in Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East.
Mr. Hook pointed out that since the United States withdrew from the Iran deal in May, the U.S. has sanctioned 53 individuals and entities for human rights abuses, proliferation activities, or acts of terrorism, including Sadegh Larijani, head of the judiciary. That designation demonstrates, he said, the United States will target those responsible for human rights abuses at the highest level of the Iranian government. As the nationwide protests in Iran confirm, the Iranian people are rightly frustrated with the regime, Director Hook said, and the United States stands with them. A people with as rich a history and as deep a culture as the Iranian people deserve a government that treats them with dignity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. Welcome
to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. Listen for Science in the News about a famous zoo animal in the U.S. Then, our American History program, Making of a Nation. But first, this report about education in America.
American high school students might have a big change in their world history education next year. The College Board announced in May that it plans to limit the amount of material covered in its Advanced Placement, or AP, World History exam. It wants the exam to test students on their knowledge of the past 560 years or so, from the year 1450 to the present. This means students would not be tested on people, places, and events before that period. They would not need to know about the Roman Empire, ancient Egyptian and Chinese history, or the Incan and Aztec civilizations before the arrival of European explorers. The College Board's proposal has received strong criticism from teachers across the United States. Some feel the move would increase the influence of Western Europe in AP World History classes. They say this also would reduce the amount of time they spend teaching about other cultures.
The College Board is an independent organization that supports the growth of U.S. higher education. The not-for-profit group directs the AP program and AP exams in U.S. high schools. Schools pay the College Board to use its AP teaching program and tests. The material chosen for the exams influences what subjects are included in the classes. Jasley Carroll, a spokesperson for the College Board, said its leadership proposed the changes because the AP World History class covers too much information. The College Board suggests spreading the material over two classes, as many U.S. colleges do. Carroll said, "Our intention is spreading the content of AP World History over two courses is to ensure that such important content is given the time it deserves. In doing this, we are following the same model that colleges use and that we have used for most other AP courses, whether in science, English, mathematics, world languages, or the arts, providing students with a foundational year of content prior to the AP year." Trevor Packer, the head of College Board's AP program, told the New York Times the plan was based, in part, on comments from history teachers. He noted that some said they struggled to teach almost 100 centuries of material in just 1 year.
However, many teachers and educators have sharply criticized the proposal. Sarah Hannon, a former history teacher, said that she was heartbroken by the proposal and that it does a disservice to teaching history. Hannon lives in Juneau, the capital of Alaska. "I think 1450 really focuses it onto a European-dominated story. It throws us back to that arrogance of Western civilization as the focus of history," she added. Peter Stearns, a professor at George Mason University in Virginia, agrees, Stearns noted that many events taking place before 1450 are important. He said they provide students a foundation to learn about more recent history. Stearns added that while he understands the need for organizing a curriculum so that students can understand history better, it is clear that 1450 is not the right date to start with. It is important, he said, to include material about the history of non-Western societies and cultures before the time of globalization. Stearns was one of several professors who signed a letter to the College Board's Trevor Packer. The letter warned that if the class were to begin at 1450, the signers would urge their universities to stop accepting AP World History for college credit.
In June, at a meeting with Packer in Utah, many teachers protested the idea. In sometimes tense discussions, teacher Amanda Doamiral explained that schools would not have the money to pay for two AP World History classes. "They don't have the money for pencils, dude," she said. "How are they going to teach that class?" Politico reported that a new pre-AP World History class would cost anywhere from $600 to $6,500, depending on the size of the school and the number of pre-AP courses being offered. High school students have entered the debate. Dylan Black, a student from New Jersey, is leading a campaign on the website change.org. He is calling on Packer to cancel his proposal. The campaign has 11,000 signatures, well above an earlier goal of 5,000.
It appears that the College Board is listening to the criticism from American educators. In an email, Jazly Carriel said the College Board was moved by the concerns about how the changes to AP World History could affect students. "We recognize how important it is for students to study non-European cultures and civilizations prior to 1450. We will address such principled concerns in a revised approach we will share soon," she said. Last month, Packer wrote that he still believes 1 year is not enough time to teach all the material currently taught in an AP World History class. He said it is important for students to learn about historical events taking place before 1450. And he promised to look for a solution that is more agreeable to educators. In response, Stearns wrote on his blog that while some educators will still be disappointed, College Board's openness is a good sign. Stearns also said that if one of the issues is how colleges organize their history classes, then maybe professors should discuss among themselves the best way for structuring their own curriculum. I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Lucia Malonig.
Imagine having an animal as your teacher. How much do you think one could learn from a hippopotamus, for example? At the Cincinnati Zoo, a baby hippo named Fiona is helping to educate young people, both in the city of Cincinnati, Ohio, and across the United States. Fiona was born at the Cincinnati Zoo in January 2017. She arrived nearly 2 months early, before her body was strong. That meant her body was smaller than that of other baby hippos. Her birth weight was so low that Fiona's caregivers feared she might not survive. But thanks to special treatments and assistance from hospital workers, Fiona stayed healthy. Her story gained national attention because of stories on traditional and social media. The young hippo is now a symbol for the Cincinnati Zoo. The zoo has used her name and image to sell a great deal of merchandise, including clothing and toys. She is also the star of at least 6 books, and she is a very popular subject for library and classroom activities. The latest book is called Saving Fiona, which the zoo's director wrote. "She has taught us a lot," director Thane Maynard told the Associated Press. Some experts believe Fiona is the smallest hippo ever to survive. She weighed only 13 kilograms at birth. That is one-third the size of a normal, fully developed baby Nile hippopotamus. She was also unable to stand or take milk from her mother. A Cincinnati Zoo worker collected milk from Fiona's mother, Bibi, by hand. And the Smithsonian Institution's National Zoo in Washington, D.C., helped develop a highly nutritional food product for her. Workers from Cincinnati Children's Hospital were asked to help inject nutrients directly into her bloodstream. Maynard notes that everyone was worried about Fiona during the first 6 months of her life. But by her first birthday, she had grown to 318 kilograms, a healthy weight for a hippopotamus that age. Maynard's book is aimed at young readers, telling them the story of Fiona's struggle to survive, while also teaching them about hippos. It includes many facts about the animals, such as the fact that adult hippos only eat plants, but can run faster than people. The book also notes adult hippos can be dangerous because of their size, weighing up to 2,270 kilograms. Part of the zoo's mission is public education, Maynard said. The book is reaching kids and families with a message of hope, never giving up. To date, all the books about Fiona, when combined, have sold tens of thousands of copies. Educators say lessons with stories involving animals appeal to students. Fiona has been on the cover of 3 Scholastic News magazines. Those magazines have reached millions of students. And the stories about Fiona came with reading exercises or mathematics problems, such as finding how many bathtubs the water in her zoo would fill. Stephanie Smith is executive director for Scholastic News for students in grades 3 through 6. She says youngsters love Fiona's story. "Kids will just gobble it up. It makes teaching easy," she said. However, Mike Schreiberg sees a problem with all the attention Fiona has been receiving. Schreiberg is with the National Wildlife Federation, a private nonprofit group. He says environmental activists see all the stories about media stars like Fiona as an avoidance of the serious difficulties hippos and other animals face. These include shrinking wildlife habitats and illegal hunting. Schreiberg argues there is a deeper message about the environment that educators should be sharing. But he admits that, growing up as a child in Cincinnati, he visited the zoo often. He says this helped influence him to become an environmental activist. Schreiberg says the attention on Fiona, which has seen her image placed on items from playing cards to alcoholic drinks, is a good thing overall. We are in favor of anything that is engaging people with wildlife, he said. You've got the American public and people around the world really caring about hippos and animals. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. History is usually a process of slow change. However, certain events also can change the course of history. Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo was such an event. So was the first airplane flight by the Wright brothers, or the meeting between the Spanish explorer Cortez and the Aztec king Montezuma. All these events were moments that changed history. And so it was, too, with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. We take you now to Washington.
The details are not available. They will be in a few minutes. The White House is now giving out a statement. The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. The president's brief statement was read to reporters by Stephen Early, the president's secretary. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war. Such an attack would naturally bring a counterattack, and hostilities of this kind would naturally mean that the president would ask Congress for a declaration of war.
The surprise attack on America's large naval base in Hawaii was a great military success for Japan. However, the attack on Pearl Harbor had more than a military meaning. The attack would force Americans to enter World War II. More importantly, it would also make them better recognize their position as one of the most powerful nations in the world. In future weeks, we will discuss the military and political events of World War II. But today, we look back at the years before the United States entered that war. The period between the end of World War I and the attack on Pearl Harbor lasted only 23 years, from 1918 to 1941. But those years were filled with important changes in American politics, culture, and traditions. We start our review of these years with politics. In 1920, Americans elected Republican Warren Harding to the presidency. The voters were tired of the progressive policies of Democratic President Woodrow Wilson. They were especially tired of Wilson's desire for the United States to play an active role in the new League of Nations. Harding was a conservative Republican, and so were the two presidents who followed him, Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover. All three of these presidents generally followed conservative economic policies, and they did not take an active part in world affairs. Americans turned away from Republican rule in the election of 1932. They elected the Democratic presidential candidate, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and they continued to re-elect him. In this way, the conservative Republican policies of the 1920s changed to the more progressive policies of Roosevelt in the 1930s.
The change happened mainly because of economic troubles.
So keep cool and keep Coolidge is the slogan of today.
The 1920s were a time of growth and business strength. President Calvin Coolidge said during his term that the chief business of the American people is business. This generally was the same belief of the other Republican presidents during the period, Warren Harding and Herbert Hoover. There was a good reason for this. The economy expanded greatly during the 1920s. Many Americans made a great deal of money on the stock market, and wages for workers increased as well. However, economic growth ended suddenly with the stock market crash of October 1929. In that month, the stocks for many leading companies fell sharply, and they continued to fall in the months that followed. Many Americans lost great amounts of money, and the public at large lost faith in the economy. Soon, the economy was in ruins, and businesses were closing their doors. President Hoover tried to solve the crisis, but he was not willing to take the strong actions that were needed to end it. As time passed, many Americans began to blame Hoover for the terrible economic depression. Democrat Franklin Roosevelt was elected mainly because he promised to try new solutions to end the Great Depression.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
Soon after he was elected, Roosevelt launched a number of imaginative economic policies to solve the crisis.
Our greatest primary task is to put people to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously. It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war, but at the same time, through this employment, accomplishing greatly needed projects to stimulate and reorganize the use of our great natural resources. Hand in hand with that, we must frankly recognize the overbalance of population in our industrial centers, and by engaging on a national scale in a redistribution, endeavor to provide a better use of the land for those best fitted for the land. Yes, the task can be helped by definite efforts to raise the values of agricultural products, and with this the power to purchase the output of our cities. It can be helped by preventing realistically the tragedy of the growing loss through foreclosure of our small homes and our farms. It can be helped by insistence that the federal, the state, and the local governments act forthwith on the demand that their cost be drastically reduced.
Roosevelt's policies helped to reduce the amount of human suffering. But the Great Depression finally ended only with America's entry into World War II. Roosevelt's victory in 1932 also helped change the balance of power in American politics. Roosevelt brought new kinds of Americans to positions of power: labor union leaders, Roman Catholics, Jews, blacks, Americans from families that had come from places such as Italy, Ireland, and Russia. These Americans repaid Roosevelt by giving the Democratic Party their votes. The 1920s and 30s also brought basic changes in how Americans dealt with many of their social and economic problems. The 1920s generally were a period of economic growth with little government intervention in the day-to-day lives of the people. But the terrible conditions of the Great Depression during the 1930s forced Roosevelt and the federal government to experiment with new policies. The government began to take an active role in offering relief to the poor. It started programs to give food and money to poor people, and it created jobs for workers. The government grew in other ways. It created major programs for farmers. It set regulations for the stock market. It built dams, roads, and airports. American government looked much different at the end of this period between the World Wars than it did at the beginning. Government had become larger and more important. It dealt with many more issues in people's lives than it ever had before. Social protest increased during the 1920s and 30s. Some black Americans began to speak out more actively about unfair laws and customs. Blacks in great numbers moved from the southern part of the country to northern and central cities. The 1920s and 30s also were a time of change for women. Women began to wear less conservative kinds of clothes. Washing machines and other inventions allowed them to spend less time doing housework. Women could smoke or drink in public, at least in large cities, and many women held jobs. Of course, the women's movement was not new. Long years of work by such women's leaders as Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony had helped women win the constitutional right to vote in 1920. The 1920s and 30s also were important periods in the arts. George Gershwin wrote his Rhapsody in Blue, originally for piano and jazz band. It later went on to become a symphony concert favorite. Writers like Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, Eugene O'Neill, and others made this what many called the golden age of American writing. Frank Lloyd Wright and other architects designed great buildings for American cities. Film actors like Clark Gable and radio entertainers like Jack Benny did more than make Americans laugh or cry. They also helped unite the country. Millions of Americans could watch or listen to the same show at the same time. Politics, the economy, social traditions, art. All these changed for Americans during the 1920s and 30s. And many of these changes also had effects in countries beyond America's borders. However, the change that had the most meaning for the rest of the world was the change produced by the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. America's modern history as a great superpower begins with its reaction to that attack. It was a sudden event in the flow of history. It was a day on which a young land suddenly became fully grown.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program on the Voice of America. And find more stories as well as activities and videos on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
from Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. Four more boys have been brought out of the cave in northern Thailand, where they had been trapped for more than 2 weeks. A Thai official says they are safe and in the hospital. Four boys and their 25-year-old coach remain in the cave. Britain's Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has resigned. It's another indication of the differences among the Prime Minister and members of her cabinet over Brexit. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Theresa May has named Dominic Raab to take up the post of senior official in charge of negotiating the country's exit from the European Union after David Davis resigned Sunday. Davis had accused May of undermining Brexit with her plan to keep close trade ties with the bloc. Raab, who is currently housing minister, was a prominent Leave campaigner during the 2016 referendum. Charles de Ledesma, London.
President Trump on Monday said he has confidence that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will honor the contract we signed for the North to denuclearize. On Twitter, Mr. Trump alleged that China may be exerting negative pressure on the deal, quote, because of our posture on Chinese trade. A court in Myanmar on Monday charged two jailed Reuters journalists with obtaining secret state documents. The ruling moves the press freedom case to its trial stage. After 6 months of preliminary hearings, the reporters have pled not guilty to the charges. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has assumed sweeping new powers as the country transitions to an executive presidency. He was sworn in Monday for a new presidential term. Deputies of his ruling AK party cheered in parliament, while the opposition sat in silence. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, during a brief unannounced trip to Kabul, Afghanistan on Monday, said the Trump administration is increasing the pressure for peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban.
They cannot wait us out. And we're beginning to see the results both on the battlefield, where the Taliban's momentum is slowing, and in the prospects for peace with them.
Pompeo met with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah. He promised support for Ghani's efforts to open talks with the Taliban. Iraq's Election Commission on Monday expanded its manual recount of ballots from May's parliamentary elections. Those elections were marred by allegations of fraud and irregularities. The son of former South African President Jacob Zuma is out on bail after a court appearance Monday to face charges of corruption. Automaker BMW is raising prices on the United States-built SUVs it sells in China because of higher tariffs. Associated Press correspondent Mike Hempen reports.
China is raising the import tax on cars from the U.S. to 40% in retaliation for higher tariffs imposed on Chinese goods by President Trump. The DPA news agency reports the Munich-based company says it's not in position to, quote, completely absorb the tariff increases, unquote. BMW builds SUV models in Spartanburg, South Carolina, where it employs 10,000 people. Those vehicles are exported to 140 countries, making BMW the largest U.S. auto exporter. I'm Mike Hempen.
Disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein remains out on bail following an arraignment today on more sexual assault charges. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Harvey Weinstein.